wow, that's great. Normally I have to wake the audience up. This is better. Good afternoon. I'm standing between you and Mickey, so I'll make it quick. First of all, the slides for this I'm sure will be billions of places, but I know they'll be there, and hopefully a webcast of this as well, and audio. Also, you'll find lots of other specific examples of reference and things of that nature there. Social networking and reference is perhaps the least inspired title that I could think of coming up with. And so as I was there last night, you know, fidgeting with the slides, I thought maybe we'd go with something like, but mom, all the other kids at Tag Clubs. Part of the reason I'm here today is because I received an email from Donna Dinberg, or Din as we call it, and I love Din, and if Din tells me to be somewhere, I'm somewhere. So when she sent me the email, she said, Dave, we'd like you to talk about this, and here are the kinds of things we want you to talk about. IM, chat services, commercial versus homegrown, Go Browsing, Meebo, plugin, social networking, MySpace, Facebook, Mashup, Flickr, YouTube, texting over reference. So I'll be here till next week. No. I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it without actually showing you one screenshot. So it should be fun. But, you know, this list is really interesting because I think this list really does a good job of typifying where we are right now in reference and in libraries in general. Which is, you know, I remember in the early days of virtual reference, as we come onto the virtual reference desk conference and such, and there was almost this, like, peer pressure going on for why aren't you doing virtual reference? Oh, my God, I have to do virtual reference. And, you know, all the cool kids were doing Dublin Core and these things. And, you know, I think we had this sort of interesting pack mentality as librarians where we feel like someone else is clearly doing something more interesting and we've got to do it. And the net result is that you end up with all this sort of social networking and participatory this and that and that. I love this picture because I think it represents it really well. This is the web trend map from 2007. And what someone did was take prominent sites like Flickr and Google and Gmail and all of the Facebook and put it on the Tokyo subway map. Now, you may not be able to see this from the back, but if you look sort of in the middle but not quite in the middle, you see this sort of green blob that says, you. And, you know, this is where we are right now. As we look at all these interesting and different technologies, it's almost like being released into a candy shop and saying, pick whatever you want. In that we see, that's the positive way of spinning it. The negative way, of course, is that we see something flashing, we jump on it. It's like birds, easily distracted. And so what I thought I'd do, rather than starting with, and this is texting, and this is IM, and this is stuff, that, hello? is I thought I would work on ask this question. You know, why social everything? And I'll just tell you right up front that I hate the phrase social. Social network, social this. Maybe it's because I'm really an introvert and I have no friends. But, you know, social networking sounds like a hookup for Friday night. And I could probably use that, but my wife wouldn't think so. And a lot of what's going on is this famous sort of phrase of... the technology is, in fact, the answer, says the consultant as he looks in and then takes a moment, turns over to someone beside him and says, now, what was the question? Right? You know, this it's really interesting that as you look at things like the Library 2.0 literature and the This 2.0 and the This 3.0, and so, there's a real interesting trend that goes through that literature. And what's really, there's a real interesting venom that goes through that literature. I don't know if you've picked up on this. But it really is sort of change. You must change. We must change. And I'm all for change. I think change is a really important thing. I think we need to constantly change. I think we need to know why we're changing. And so oftentimes what I'm struck with is the notion that we feel this obligation to take on anything that's new. And one of the things, I'm working on a book chapter, so excuse this rather obscure metaphor, you know, if you can read it later in the book chapter. In the really early days of navigation, back when the Greeks were putting boats on the ocean and the Portuguese were just starting to put boats on the ocean and take over and, you know, rape and pillage and all that horrible stuff, they couldn't ever sail farther out into the ocean than they could see the shore. So they would have charts that would tell them this is how to get to XYZ location, and they would all be landmarks on the shore. And so they would have to stay always within view of the shore, because if they ever lost sight of those landmarks, they would be lost and they would, in essence, die at sea. Hence the idea of falling off the end of the ocean. And what it took after a while is someone figured out that using technology and these stars above us that don't change on a regular basis, we figured out, and I always get these wrong, but I believe it's latitude, which is north and south from the equator. And so now using the sextant, you could figure out how north and south, how close you were to, and that took a couple hundred years. But you still had to stay within shore, because now you could tell how north and south you were, but you still had no idea how east and west you were. And it wasn't until we developed fine metalworks and springs for good clocks that we could take out into the ocean and set by the time back where at home, which turned into Greenwich Mean Time, that we could now figure out how east-west we were, and those became the meridians and all this wonderful stuff. My point with this story, what, is there are no lines marked in the earth on north and south. You don't trip over the equator. Really bad joke about anyway. But the point is, it's a conceptual framework, and it's such a powerful conceptual framework of using time and stars that we use it today. I rented a GPS system that I got in my car, and while the stars are no longer the North Star and Polaris and such, they're now GPS satellites, and the time is no longer distance from Greenwich Mean Time, but time of transmission between these satellites. These concepts have allowed us to map the entire Earth and swim away from shore. And I think a lot of times with librarianships, without these deeper concepts and these more fundamental understanding, it's really easy to look for the landmarks and determine that's where the future is. And unfortunately, those landmarks have become increasingly technology-oriented, and they've become increasingly technology from outside of our own discipline. Now, instead of using this is the lighthouse and this is the Cliffs of Dover, we're using this is Twitter's new feature and Google's new option. But what we're trying to do is not swim too far out from the shore, because we're not quite sure where that Earth falls off. And so what I wanted to is work a little bit today to talk about why social and why all this technology, but not from the sense of this is what you can do, but this is where we can ground this. And so the other example I have here, this is the Optimus Maximus keyboard, which has nothing to do with Transformers. And if you're a geek like me, you've probably heard about it. The Optimus Maximus keyboard is, yes, $1,600. And yours today. No. Why? Because every one of the keys on there is actually a little OLED screen. They're actually little screens that you can program. And so, for example, when you hit the shift key, all the characters suddenly draw themselves in uppercase. And you can program, you see there they program, for example, a Firefox button or Internet Explorer or Word button. So you can actually program any key to show you any character, which is cool. It turns out it sucks to type on. It's got no return whatsoever. So you start to go click, click, click. And so what we have is something that technologically is capable. We're able to do this. And it's really cool at some level, but it's really expensive and frankly sort of useless when it comes to the purpose that we want to solve. So what we want to do is sort of avoid that. Now, I should also preface this, and I have some people who can stand up and give testimonials, that I am in fact an unreformed, unrelenting geek. And so this notion about technology as the answer could well have come from me in many situations. So if you want to get down and dirty and talk PHP code and internet domains and routers and all that stuff, we can do it. I blog, I wiki, I do it all. But the question that I want to work on today is why. And I want to start out in a very, very obscure community participation kind of way. And that is, and rather than starting with why social, I want to start with how we think. All right? So I'm going to give you a word. I'm hopefully going to give you a word. There's the word. All right? And I want you to think about what that word means. Just what is that word? All right? Keep it in your mind. Right there. Got it? All right. By show of hands, how many people look at a formula when you thought of it and said, that is, in fact, a chemical combination? I was right there. How many people thought that is, in fact, a mathematical expression? Very good. How many people thought it was baby food? New parents of the world unite. Now, this is interesting, right? Now, what happens if I, in fact, did this to begin with? Now, how many people think it's baby food? Right? It may well be. Right? these terms, these words, it's amazing that we're able to communicate on a regular basis because of this situation. What we run into every day is the fact that words mean multiple things, and we learn them in different ways, and we come to associate them in different ways. And so when you take these concepts and you move them out of the context in which they're presented, they become loose, they become flexible, they become malleable. But when you bring back a context, boom, comes right back to you. Let's go with another one. Light. All right? Take a moment. Okay. Illumination. How many people thought illumination? Very good. How many people thought set a fire? We'll be watching you. It's California. Everything's on fire. All right. All right, standard California, how can you live here, joke, pestilence. Okay, now, not heavy. Okay, how about now? It's like an eye test. Better, worse, better, worse. One more. Now, I know the reason you're laughing is because you were all thinking about the object management group. Or perhaps Omnicom Media Group. And maybe, just maybe, a few of you were thinking about, oh my God. Right? Now here's one. What technology am I talking about with oh my God? So in fact, from these two concepts, I can actually build out the third, which is, it's from a cell phone, right? Now, why I keep coming back to you is this idea that somehow the world can be reduced to one way of organizing it or understanding it doesn't work. That we learn things in context. And in fact, what happens is we can scaffold these concepts together. Our memory and how we think about it is relational. I know you're sitting there going, Dave, how does this deal with that? That's the messaging. We're getting there. So what happens if we take these scaffolded concepts, formula as chemical combination, light as illumination, and oh my God, right? What happens when we put these things together? I'm not singing It's a Small World after all. Right? I put these images together. Oh, okay, yeah, that's fine. I can see that. That can add. Fire, you know, gunpowder has a chemical formula and lights in there. Okay, that's fine. So I want to try a few more other things, because what's happening is, I'm just quickly demonstrating, this is how our brains work. Our brains take concepts and put them together. And they don't put them in these nice little stacks and orders and boxes. It puts them together as networks of connected concepts and connected ideas. In fact, the neurobiologist will tell you that if we didn't think this way, this conversation would really suck. Because if you look at the actual time it takes to transmit electrical signals through your neurons to get to the part of the brain that stores language and get it back and recall it and connect it together, it would take about 12 seconds between utterances. So I would have to talk like that. But we don't. We anticipate what's coming next. We know, for example, if I talk about catalogs, that you're probably thinking about library catalogs and not things from JCPenney's. Right? I'm in a library conference. I'm not expecting him, when he talks about catalogs, to talk about cashmere. I'm expecting him to talk about Mark, what have you. Right? So I want to give you a few more of these. And what's happening is, how do we get these in our heads? Well, we go to school. We listen to our parents. We experience daily life. We get education. We go through life and we build up these connections. And increasingly, as you get older, past the age of about 4, these concepts become socially derived. In essence, because you grew up in America or you grew up in whatever country, you will have certain connections that others may not. Because you have Masters of Library Science, you will have connections that others may not make, that they're not your own. They're socially derived. Let me give you an example of that. What am I talking about? Clearly, I am talking about the wonderful book by Carol Walter on sticky buns. Right? A book about buns. How about this one? Nike. Right? See, idea, and just one... I'll let you fill in the picture yourself on this. All right, Caleb was talking about, what do we call things and what do we write them? We have to understand there's baggage here. Right? The language that we use and that we communicate back and forth comes from somewhere. It is not naturally derived. It is not organic. I'm sorry. It is not inorganic. I'm going to take a moment.
the language that we use is not sort of existent in the world that we discover. We create it socially. We create it. We understand these things.
Now, this concept of taking terms, and I'm just working with words now. We could have done with images. Taking terms and realizing that they are socially derived has great utility. Right? And so, for example, when you look at things like tagging, take a moment.
Now that should clear up a few things around here, he says.
This has great utility. We see this in things like Flickr, and we see these in tag clouds, and we see all this interesting information. And it does have great utility. In fact, it has great utility because most of the library profession is based on these concepts. Dewey, anyone? Library of Congress classification, anyone? These concepts that somehow one word describes one thing is ridiculous. And even in the library world, we gave that up a long time ago, and so we built hierarchies. And the idea that somehow these meanings cascade, but you can see from Caleb's example of virtual reference that that doesn't necessarily even flow through. I don't agree with this. I do agree with this. I don't do it. And so tagging is a good example of where it turns out that if you get a group to put terms on something, it actually, over time, with enough people working on it, kind of does well to identify something online. I would point out that if you look at tagging, a lot of us are looking in catalogs and saying, can we add tag clouds and can we tag books and all this other stuff. I would warn you that the other data it shows is that tagging is very temporally set. And what does that mean? That means that if I asked you to come up and give me 10 keywords about this object, and I came back to you a year later and just gave you the keywords, you would have no idea what this object is, right? This idea that, for example, 9/11 to us has a real interesting, unique, and definite context, and yet in 2000, if I had said 9/11 to you, you would have thought I was calling for help, right? Concepts change over time, and so by simply adding folksonomies onto things and assuming that they will make sense forever, we are nuts. It is why we have god-awful bureaucratic meetings about what word should be put in what part of the classification scheme, and why oftentimes people ignore. You know, it's interesting, if you look at adaptations of classification outside of the library field, people think they're brilliant ideas. They come together in a meeting, they develop a taxonomy, they put it on their website, they say, usability solved. And then they forget that every year you've got to go back and check it and change it and add it. Group editing. Wikis. Well, how does that have to do with tagging? Well, this idea of relational concepts. That what happens is, reason group editing, why wikis work really well, is that we get in there and we can futz with meaning back and forth. We can come to conclusions over time. We can say, this word's not quite right. I was in a committee meeting this morning, and I swear to God, it was like living in a wiki. You bring up the mission statement, it's like, well, do we want to use the word equitable, or do we want to use equity? Okay. And so, you know, it's just, I mean, how many people admit it are the wordsmiths? How many people, yeah, all right, we love them, we hate them, right? We love them after the fact, but during the meeting, they've got to die. But this idea that somehow concepts that over time that are socially derived, which means that we come to these terms and these relationships as a group as opposed to individuals, also has really interesting implications for credibility. And so, for example, Caleb, I'm just going to keep mentioning him again and again, brought up Google and how Google really changed and made search work. How did they do it? They did it by this concept. Google is a social search engine. Now, in today's language and lingo, we don't look at it that way because somehow people aren't manually adding things back and forth. But how does Google work? Google works on PageRank. What it means is, out in the internet, organically, are a bunch of web pages, and they point to each other. Any page that gets pointed to most, in this case the center node, will instantly bump up in a result set. So what they are using is an organic social definition of relevancy. That means the thing that's pointed to the most is the most important. And it turns out that it is a fabulous surrogate for many, many things. Relevancy is one. Utility is another. Importance is another. It's not perfect. We know that we can mess with it all the frickin' time. Thank you, bloggers, right? The idea that somehow we can Google bomb, if you haven't read about Google bombing is cool. You can't do it anymore because Google figured it out. But the notion that when you went into, what is it, complete failure? And it pointed to the White House site, and then like 2 days later pointed to Hillary Clinton's website, because everyone started realizing that if they put in the keywords with the right link, they can manipulate Google results. And we say, oh, they fixed that. But the truth is, if you put in Apple
into the search engine, you will learn much more about computers than you will about fruits. Right? The idea that if you put in flowers, you will get more shopping sites than you will get others. Right? So even though they're socially derived, that also means they're easily manipulated and the algorithms matter. What if we could take that concept of socially derived meaning and put it into a little bit more unique context, which is rather than taking what everyone in the world thinks, let's pick a particular interesting subgroup like, say, librarians. And let's take an even more interesting subgroup of librarians, reference librarians, because you guys are much more interesting than the average bear. So what if, instead of looking at which pages everyone else points to, we looked at what pages reference librarians pointed to? And so we developed this concept, you know, trademark, no, called reference weighting. And what reference weighting works is we still have those websites sitting up there, but rather than looking at how they point to each other, what we're going to do is in transactions look at which ones the reference librarians point to. All right? So what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at transcripts. And we're going to pull out of those transcripts. Now, we can't take the transcripts 100%, privacy issues, all that stuff. All we're going to do is grab the URLs that you folks point to. All right? So if you put a URL, and not from the patron, just from you, we take the URLs that you folks point to, and we actually worked with OCLC, and we took 3-4 months of question point transactions, mined all the URLs out of them, and we threw them into Google. Right? Google lets you say, you know, just search these sites, roll your own website. So we did that. So all the algorithms are the same. All the underlying technology is the same. Just the selection criteria is different. One selection criteria is reference librarians pointing to it. The other is Google used their normal page rank. And what we then did was a pretest where we asked, given these results, which do you find more credible? Same interface, same algorithm, same look and feel. The only difference, and unknown to the person doing the rating, was that reference librarians picked them and not a general search. That red line at the top are the pages that came from question point. The URLs derived from question point. And all of these criteria, these different queries, 1 through 20 are different queries, are credibility markers. And what it means is that red line says that almost every query except for one, the results that came from reference librarians were found to be more credible than the ones that came from general Google. People trusted them more, even if they didn't know they were reference librarians picking them. This is interesting, right? Because now we're coming up with these connections, these socially derived connections, but not general society, from a subset, from reference librarians, and we're finding impact. This should make everyone very happy, because what it means is even if they don't know they need us, they still like us. Right? And so we looked at reference extract and we started asking the same, we asked an interesting question, which is, do reference librarians, right? So we're going to go back to those words, formula, light, okay? And you know, what's interesting is you notice that in each example there was a majority opinion, not universal, but a majority, oh, that usually means mathematical formula, for example. And we asked the question, if we look at the consistency, the way that you folks cite URLs, is there a consistency there? Do librarians tend to point to the same stuff over and over again? Let me give you an example. This is what's called a histogram of URLs mentioned by an old service in 1992 to 2000 something called AskAir. Right? And what you see is every one of those colors, and they start to mesh together at the top, is a different website. Okay? So, for example, the light blue band at the bottom, those are the percentage of time people pointed to the Department of Education's website. The dark blue pointed to a service called EDRS, which was the document delivery service for Eric. The orange line was actually the document delivery part of the document delivery website. Can you tell when they changed their website? So they merged them together. Right? This is an amazingly, what this thing shows you, because you can see those nice consistent bands, says that this service pointed to the same websites consistently over and over again. Okay, I can break this down, but if you get the general, just the visual impression, right? And this makes sense because this service had policies that said every time you answer a question, you must include an Eric search, and every time you include an Eric search, you must include information about document delivery, right? Policy enforcing. This is Kids Connect. This is how school librarians answered questions about kids' questions on anything and everything in the world. And it's a very early service, so you're looking at about 96 data. 1996, and earlier data, so there weren't a lot of consistent websites. You notice there's very little consistency. By the way, the blue is Google at the bottom. Right? So this, just to show you how screwed up life can really be, I know, this looks like Art Deco. I love these pictures. This, see, you didn't know you were going to be forced to look at data today. Dinner. This is how scientists refer to information when asked questions. From the National Science Digital Library, they were getting questions on what is a black hole, what is the meaning of life, are there little green men on Mars, whatever. This is their citation pattern. What's interesting about this one is you notice it's completely chaotic. There's no consistency whatsoever. They'll point to lots of stuff. The other thing is you'll notice that all the bands are pretty thick, all those little areas of color, versus, say, Ask Eric. I know we're podcasting, so I'll be right back. See all these little itty-bitty ones up here? That means lots and lots and lots and lots of sites, like 30,000 of them. See how there aren't that many color bands here? That means scientists don't cite.
They cite themselves and the other scientists.
That's right. But this isn't citation pattern, formal citation pattern. This is literally answers to kids' questions. So when you ask them what a black hole is, they'll say it's a big gravity sink. That's the answer. You ask a reference librarian, they'll say, NASA says it's whatever. Right? All right, ready for question point data? This is about a year old data. How consistent are you guys? Woo! Solid, baby. By the way, number one, from this sample, the number one site was Public Law Library in California. The number two was Wikipedia. Caleb, number one cited for Oregon?
Wikipedia.
So let's stop having that conversation, shall we? All right. My point of all of this, right, is that what happens is reference librarians, you folks, consistently point out connections. Now, this could be groupthink, but in fact, this is the thing that we're going to talk about building search engines upon. Right? I want you to think about that for a moment because I'm coming back to what's this texting, what does it have to do with social networking? What I'm getting to the point is that we as human beings relate information together. We come up with relations. We don't store things as chunks. And it turns out with certain subgroups like us, we do it in a very consistent way. All right? Now, the other thing that I need to add here is something called scaffolding, which is what we do is we build concepts upon other concepts. Right? So we learn that 2 plus 2 is 4. We then learn that 2 times 2 is 4. And we learn that because what we have is two twos. And now that we understand those concepts, we can go on and go on and go on. You know, if you've been in classes and instruction, this is where we build foundational knowledge and we then add additional knowledge on top of. Right? If you've ever been in, by the way, very, very bad instruction, they don't do that. They say things like, click here, now click here, now click here. And if you stop and say, why, they say, now click here. Right? Now, I'm just going to take a little aside for a moment. Think about the systems that we put in front of our users, like catalogs. Right? Think about catalogs for a moment and think about their scaffolded, their knowledge, their socially understood and derived meaning that they are bringing to your catalogs. And think about how completely useless it is. That if they don't, why is it that study after study shows that librarians find catalogs extraordinarily effective? You folks find catalogs brilliant. You do. When you put them side-by-side studies, you folks can work those systems left and right. And you put a user in front of them, and it falls flat. Oh, well, that's because they don't know something. That's right, because they didn't take 2.5-year master's degree to figure it out. Right? So the same thing that annoys me about people talking about how books are so intuitive. Yeah, we only take, 8 years of someone's life to teach them how to read? Right? There's everything is miscellaneous. There's a great little story that the author tells about how in the middle of meetings, everyone has their laptops opening, and so when they hear something they don't talk, they can go do a quick web search. They learn about it, and therefore they can be better in the conversation. And he says, therefore, we have commoditized knowledge into little bits, and we can consume them on demand. The problem is, how do they know which website to go? Did they know how to read the language? Did they understand the domain? There's so much scaffolding that, of course, when I bring up a concept like cataloging, I don't take 10 hours to do it because you've already had 300 hours of it before you showed up. Right? Now, we can scaffold concepts, and I want to take, and I'm moving to the social stuff, I really promise. And I want to talk about how sort of interesting the scaffold concepts. And so here are two concepts, the Spanish Crusades and modern medicine. Okay? And these are related. And I'm going to give you the relation. I'm going to do it relatively quickly. The Muslims occupied the Iberian Peninsula in Spain during the Dark Ages, during the Middle Ages. And what happened was, at one point, the Pope sent mercenaries to go liberate the southern Spain from the Moors. He did this primarily to get rid of the mercenaries from destroying every other part of Europe. And they went in and they ransacked it and they took the city, which in truth didn't happen because it was basically a handshake deal because everyone had intermarried by that point. And when they got into the city and took over the city, what did they find there? They found thousands of libraries, amazing libraries, full of all these huge volumes of text. And most of the text was in Arabic, but was translated from the original Greek. And what it turned out is that they had rediscovered all the information they had lost in the rest of Europe. And so what happened was they began translating all these Arabic texts, rediscovering algebra, rediscovering Aristotle, rediscovering Socrates, and this huge flood of information hit all of Europe. And what happened is people realized that if they could understand and take root in this knowledge, primarily in law, they could get ahead in the world. And so in order to do this, what happened is people banded together and they hired tutors in the topic that would come and teach this. And those tutors eventually became professors, and those bands of students eventually became colleges and then universities. And the model of students hiring the professor became the predominant model of higher education until actually in the 18th century in modern medicine, what was happening is students were hiring their professors to teach them to be doctors. And they didn't necessarily take well to getting a bad grade. So what happened is we were producing doctors who knew nothing of medicine. In fact, when the president of Harvard declared that we should have a written examination for doctors, all the professors balked and fought against it because none of their students were literate. Right? And so what happened is Johns Hopkins is they decided they had to change this model. One of the major models they changed was the idea that you hired the professors as faculty and the students paid tuition, but it wasn't a direct correspondence. This radically changed and improved medicine, and to this day what we deal with is people practicing medicine taught rigorously by a faculty in a clinical setting. So clearly, the Crusades led directly to modern medicine. Now, you don't find that in a history book because it doesn't come from one text. It's not a linear concept, and yet you can follow it. And what's interesting is if I then asked me, Dave, cite this, I would cite things like, well, I went to Wikipedia to learn about the Spanish Crusades. And then there's this guy named James Burke who did The Day the Universe Changed that talks a lot about the idea of the impact of this information flowing into Europe. And then I learned a lot in World Book. And then if you ever wanted, by the way, the best book ever written in terms of modern medicine, The Great Influenza by John Barry, who talks about the modernization of medicine. The point is, this relation of these concepts had actually very little to do with the artifacts in which they were derived. And yet, I would ask you, what is your job? If you define your job as getting someone to a thing, you're in the wrong business. Because what you're doing is you're going back to this idea that somehow knowledge can be commoditized in little units that we can hand to people. And when you keep going with that logic, you believe that you can somehow organize these commoditized bits of knowledge for everyone in the world, and then you begin to make the horrible mistake that somehow these little bits are true, or right, or correct. And you forget that all of those things are simply artifacts of the process of relating information together, which is all about context. Your job is not to get someone to a thing. I think all the time when I hear a lot about virtual reference, it almost always turns into having conversations with undergraduates about knowing what a journal article is. Wow! Great, I'm a tour guide on the information superhighway. What your job is to get someone to knowledge, to get them to understand. And if our job is about connecting things in people's heads, about making sense and educating them, our job is about context and connections and not the things we're pointing to. We've realized now for the past 20 years that you can have a library with no collection, that you guys make a library, a big bin of books does not a library make. It's you who bring order and organization and understand how that makes a difference in people's life with an education mission that makes you into a library. So a real clear example . This is the Gutenberg Bible. Well, this isn't it. It's a picture of the Gutenberg Bible. Right? And Gutenberg Bible is a great example because I love the Gutenberg Bible because this was the end of memory. And now we're having discussions that Wikipedia is the end of memory. So someday, memory will end. But who will be there to remember that it happened? Now, what's great about this book is it's just the same thing that I started with the word formula. This is exactly the same thing as the word formula. Because some people look at the Gutenberg Bible and they see it as the origin of printing. They look at this as a landmark in information containment. They look at it as a historical referent. Yet others look at this as an artifact to be preserved. They look at it and they worry about the binding. They worry about how we can keep it in an airtight container. By the way, did you realize there's a Gutenberg Bible in Austin, Texas? Okay. Oil money is a great thing. I love that story, right? The Texas folks, right? The idea that some percentage of the oil wealth had to go to universities, but they couldn't use it for capital improvement or personnel, so they just started buying stuff. And so there's like all this amazing stuff in the middle of Austin, Texas. So if you ever, you know.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing.
Touché. All right. And the crowd turns on him. Okay.
Some people see this as an artifact to be preserved. Others look at this as a religious truth. Right? People look at this and they say, it's the Bible. This is the truth. And some people mean literally, this is the truth. Right? All of these are different views of that artifact, that thing. And all of them have massive and different implications for that. So what are we trying to do in a reference interview? We're trying to understand the context. What is I get myself in trouble. Susan can back me up on this one. But for many years, people say, oh, there's Dave Lankus. He doesn't like the reference interview. Because in early conferences, I always said, what is the use of the reference interview? And people always interpreted that as, so what's the use of the reference interview? When really it was, what is the use of the reference interview? And the answer is to figure out where we're going with this. Right? Now, this is the real important part. That ring around the object is your job. Not the thing in the middle. Reference, by its very nature, has become about the world of context. Reference started out radically differently. Reference started out as a patch on bad indexes. Reference started out as the systems are too complicated, we'll put the help system in, and there she is. Right? Now, this is the truth, because I'll argue this isn't just the world that reference needs to be in. This is the world libraries need to be in. That ring around the object is what we've always been about. We've just used tools that are efficient for doing that, like books and materials. I always say equating libraries with books is like equating dentists with drills. It's what's predominant in the public mind and not necessarily the most important thing they do. What's also an interesting analogy is, when is the last time you walked out of a dentist where you did not need to get a filling done and said, thank God I went to the dentist? You walk out and you go, boy, I did a good job brushing and flossing my teeth. Right? Yet, if without the dentist to understand that whole process, we would have a problem. What is the context that matters here? What is the important thing here? It's the user that defines that context, not the object. We've known for years that when you catalog a book, we're not somehow magically pulling out the descriptive information from the book. We're applying our worldview upon the book. We did a really interesting technical study looking at metadata assignments. So in K-12 education, right now there's a fixation on things called academic standards. They say, you should be teaching these things. Right, so you need to teach this mathematical concept or this English context, things like that. And the goal from National Science Foundation was to automatically read a lesson plan or read an educational module and assign a standard. And we thought this wouldn't be too tough because standards are standards. They're well-formulated, well-thought-out ontologies. And what we found out was we could get almost as good as people doing it, but the problem was if you get two people doing it, they have two different answers. Because what we finally realized, we're slow, is that we were applying the standard to the object. It wasn't that the object was somehow comporting to the standard. In education, we know this a lot of times. If you give a same lesson plan to two different teachers and you ask, is this a good lesson plan or a bad lesson plan? One teacher will say it's a horrible lesson plan. The other will say it's great. And you'll ask, why is this a horrible lesson plan? They go, it doesn't have evaluation criteria. It doesn't have the link to standards. It's not well structured. Why was this one great? It had a picture of George Washington, and I'm teaching him tomorrow. Right? The way in which we interpret this information is completely user-driven. And yet, if you look at the focus of a lot of the efforts that we do in library land, and I include reference within that, it is object-driven. And you say, oh, those catalogers have screwed it up royally. You're right, Dave. And I ask you, subject guides, anyone? Pathfinders, anyone? Caleb talked about usability testing. A lot of what I would argue that you need to do in terms of usability testing is literally identify the language that people are using in the world. And understand that that language is not a product of bad, good, indifferent education. It is a socially derived meaning. So what does this participatory approach tell us? And then I'm bringing up the big technology again. It tells us, first of all, that the user is in complete control. Now, this stuff seems relatively simple, but I would argue that if you take it to a logical conclusion, a lot of what we do changes. For example, where is those Ask a Librarian button that we've been talking about all day? Take a moment. It's an obvious answer. Nope. It's on a library website. Because clearly the user's website is the library website, right? Right? And so what we try and do is say, oh, we'll get a Facebook app. We'll put it in Facebook. Well, this is a good start. But the notion is, think about for a moment how reference is. We modeled virtual reference on physical reference, which is a facility which we stand by for someone to come into our information, ask us a question, where we have better tools. What blows me away, and I don't want to pick on any one particular vendor, but isn't it amazing that when we look at the tools that we provide librarians in this transaction and we look at ones that we provide user, isn't it amazing that they basically surrender and say, you outgunned me, I'm going away? Because we can pump scripts at them, right? I mean, virtual reference software is the best piece of software I've ever seen to make people sound like machines. A librarian will be with you shortly. I am reading your question now. I will be with you shortly. Did you do this, right? This notion that this is a human interaction, but what's more important, it's a user's interaction. They should have as good of tools as possible. The other one, that somehow it's a one-to-one. Who defines reference uniquely as one-to-one? Now, Caleb and I actually don't disagree on this. Caleb would tell you there is important times when it should be a one-to-one interaction, and I agree. But I would also argue there are many times when you want a many-to-many interaction. That when a user is working on something, what Caleb talked about, these larger stories, you're only one point in that story. Can't we provide systems that allow people a little bit longer length than that? So the analogy is, rather than having the physical desk where I sit, look unbusy, and smile, and wait for the reference librarian to come up to me, because there's absolutely no power relationship going on right here, right now. I'm not standing above you at all, right? What we do is imagine instead that someone walks in and we give them a desk. You got a question? Here's your table. And what they begin doing is they pull up materials and resources, they begin laying them out on the table, and they begin making piles. And we all do piles. Oh, this pile is about this, and this pile is about that, and these authors agree, and these authors don't disagree. And now when I have a question, I can invite you, the librarian, over and say, I'm stuck. And rather than you start with the most insulting virtual reference question ever, have you searched Google, we can start with, give me a second. Hey, that's an interesting connection. I see when you're talking about formula, you've got all these chemistry books. I don't have to start with baby formula. Right? This notion that somehow we can expose the user's thinking and their connections to us as opposed to us pulling it out of them, or as Sarah Weissman said, putting them on the rack until they tell us the truth. This is a user-oriented view. It's not just about being in Facebook. It's also being Facebook in the sense of what are the norms, what are the cultures, what's expected. I heard a lot of reference librarians when they were presenting about Facebook talking about how they could get out of the anti-spam filters because they were trying to sort of send unsolicited information to these people to inform them. It's like, you're spamming them? Maybe this isn't where you want to be? Right? This isn't the culture. I'm not expected to do that. It's all about learning. When you talk about facilitating knowledge, when you talk about a reference transaction as facilitating someone's knowledge, access is only one part of that. This concept that we still have of the neutral librarian, where you ask the reference question, you walk them to the shelves, you point to the book and walk away so that you may not disorient them or provide them with some bias, is crap. This idea that somehow, it's like walking someone into this room and saying, learn. It doesn't work that way. Access to information, pointing them to the article, pointing them to the online database is insufficient for knowledge acquisition. And if we're in the knowledge business, we need to understand it. We need to know what is the necessary information they need to consume this data. So when someone asks a question about black holes, are they asking because they're a graduate physics student or are they asking it because they're a 12th grader? Or they're asking because they're 5 years old, they just heard on TV. Context kinds of matters, right? So what do you already know, and what do I have to bring up to speed? Now, we do some of this. For example, here it's in this online database, dot, dot, dot. Do you have any clue what an online database is, right? We try and do some of that in our interaction and processes. How about the engaging environment? A lot of what Marie Radford's work, for example, on the question encountering is the language that we use back and forth is setting up an environment. Are we inviting people to learn, or are we simply in a functionary way providing them data? We used to provide a service called Virtual Reference Desk where we'd send questions to all these different services, and one of them was called Ask Dr. Neutrino. And eventually we stopped sending questions to Ask Dr. Neutrino. Why? Because they gave the wrong answer? No, they gave great answers. Why? Because every so often they say, as you should have learned in high school physics, this is the answer. Okay? The best thing you can do is go through your transcripts and you will find the equivalent of that in some of your own reference librarian's answers. Right? The third one, by the way, is motivation, which is to, you know, hey, good job, good find, recognizing that information some way, which it comes back to the social. Because how do we recognize the user contributions to our libraries? Huh? We don't even put our own faces and names up on our library websites. You want to put our users up there? Yeah. Right? This idea that they're all in control. Learning is a collaborative conversation. The library serves as facilitators. True facilitation means shared ownership. You want to know how to improve your virtual reference service? Where is your advisory board that includes users on a regular basis? If your primary users are K-12 students, how many high schoolers do you bring in each day to sit down and go through the transcripts and ask how you're doing? How many of them do you determine how you name services? How many people that when they don't find an answer in the catalog, right, the two answers that a catalog gives to a zero-hit response, I'm stupid or you're stupid, right? Put in a query to your catalog, and does it say, did you check the spelling on this? Did you do this? How did you screw up? And how many of them say, oh, interlibrary loan, meaning we clearly don't have it. Go to interlibrary loan. What about the third option of don't see it, add it? And people go, oh, can't add it. They're asking the question. How do they know the answer? Why not ask a reference question? So the next time a user puts in that query, instead of getting zero results, they get a question and an answer that has the pointer. Or, God forbid, someone else finds it and they do have the answer and they upload the document or put a new pointer in. This idea that somehow we lock down the system so that it is librarian patron, we need to blur it left and right. How many people, when you get a question from a faculty member, ever in the response say, and by the way, do you mind if I send you a question or two every so often? Incorporating the actual faculty or community official. I got to remember our hands, so you lonely public librarians. How many of you send questions on a regular basis or have a liaison within the mayor's office so that when you get questions about Department of Public Works or Human Services, you can, on a regular way, connect back and forth, and they use the same systems? Okay. Invest in tools for creation over the collection of artifacts. That's not directly a reference answer, but the notion, once again, that instead of someone coming and looking for your frequently asked questions or looking for your pathfinders, do we give them the tools to create their own pathfinders? their own frequently asked questions. So when someone comes in and they're the manga expert, we see this all the time. We have manga clubs in our library. Do we have them online so that people can blog about manga, people can create pathfinders for manga, and the library is the place to provide some of that? And by the way, we're pointing to external services, and they can post it in their MySpace pages. So taking these central concepts, and coming back to Din's email. Now, instead of looking at this as a bunch of lists of independent items, now let's take our new navigational apparatus, our theory and our concepts, and now look at them. Why is it that IM works very well for reference when it does not involve page pushing and co-browsing? Why is that? Well, let's see. Because fundamentally I'm having a conversation, and you know what? IM and chat work pretty well for that. Not all cases. Sometimes co-browsing makes sense. But what is IM allowing us to do? Have a conversation. Talk to people. What is chat in real time? Have a conversation. Talk to things. Chat services, delightful. I think it's great. But I think it's also very interesting that if you ask a bunch of college students what chat looks like and what we call chat, they're radically different. We don't use internet relay chat services. We don't have 50 people coming into a cauldron of discussion and letting them sort of fight out what they're talking about. What we do is we say, no, it's a formal one-to-one thing on my page. We don't give you a client to install in your own system. Commercial versus homegrown, I don't care. Homegrown, I do care about them. Because here's the real problem, is that these systems don't yet exist. One of the things that I really, really worry about, that as a library profession, we do, when we constantly sail close to the shore and look for these landmarks, is we constantly seek to adapt technology that was not developed for our purposes. And so this concept of knowledge creation, it's like, are we in the same business as Google? No. Thank you. What business is Google in? Advertising. Not just commercial money stuff, thank God, but advertising. Well, everything they do to draw eyes is, right? Are we in the same business as Amazon? No. What are they doing? Selling items. Not even books. I love the idea that somehow Amazon is books. You can buy, like, yard furniture on Amazon and drills. They're the Walmart of online environments. Right? They're selling things. What are libraries doing? They should be facilitating conversations to increase the knowledge of their community. That's a big word for it. We should be in the world of education. We are in the same business as professors and as teachers and as K-12 institutions. That's the world that we should be looking for, saying, you know what the number one piece of technology that if you're in an academic environment you should care a lot about? Course management systems. Why should you care about them? Because they're becoming the primary system and they suck. Course management systems suck. You know why they suck? They suck for the same reason catalogs suck, which is they're thing-based. I have a professor. I upload a bunch of readings. I upload a quiz. Go. Where's the context? Where's the flow? Where's the movement? Where's the discussion? Oh, we have a discussion board. Can I discuss directly, topic by topic, this article? Well, no, you can read the article when they come. Right? It doesn't make sense. This is the world that we have the opportunity to work in. So when you go into Mevo, that's IM. Plugins, IM. Social networking. Why do people do social networking? Because they're looking to, like, make a date? Sure, maybe. But a lot of the reason you look at the use of social network sites, you look at Wikipedia versus Encarta. The growth for Wikipedia goes up here, and Encarta stays like this. They're both encyclopedias. One allows you to participate, control, and shape it. One does not. Why do social networking sites go crazy? It's not the functionality. If you ever look at the functionality of something like Flickr or Facebook, or they're really low. They're thin. Right? I can blog. I can add this box. I mean, it really isn't a very sophisticated set of features we give them. Now look at your catalogs. You can do all this wonderful stuff, right? Well, what the difference is that with all that wonderful capability we have in our catalogs and everything else, we force people through one route. With Facebook and MySpace, they can shape the world around them. When you want to learn, you want to engage in conversation. When you engage in conversation, you assume you have power in that relationship. You assume that you get to shape part of that conversation. There are two people involved. Are our library systems, in essence, lecturing to our users? In essence, doing what I'm doing right now. Right? Are they telling the users how it's organized or what we can get? Or are they engaging them to say, what do you need and where can we go? I agree with Caleb. Reference is an essential part of that. I just hope that that idea can get pushed to all parts of the library and isn't seen just as that crazy department up front. Right? Flickr, YouTube, texting for reference, yeehaw. My point with all of this, I told you I'd talk about it all. I didn't say I'd talk about it well or in depth. My point with all of this is that reference has an obligation here. You have an obligation here. This is a cord that I have used many, many years now. First of all, our obligation is to innovate from core principles. We have an obligation. First of all, play. Go nuts. When you see new technology, play with it. I am a huge believer in play. If you don't Twitter, Twitter. If you don't blog, blog. Go crazy, because how can you tell whether something matches core principles or not if you don't know what it is? So don't dismiss any technology out of hand. But realize that you're playing. And realize that playing often does not involve a committee. Innovate from core principles. When you look at whether we're going to text or MySpace or SMS or, and here's a real good one, make our own systems, what are we basing them on? Are we basing them on these nearshore landmarks where we say, well, everyone's going to Facebook. Clearly, Facebook is the way for us to go. Well, why do we stop and ask the question, why is everyone going to Facebook? I would argue they're going to Facebook because it's a world that they control and shape and have conversations in. They are looking at online environments that they can develop systems for. Is anyone familiar with the sucks.com phenomenon? Sucks.com is brilliant. There isn't a site. I'm sure there is a site. I'm scared to find what's on it. But what happened is someone went into Walmart. They went to complain. They wouldn't let them, so they put up walmartsucks.com. Right? And then, so anytime you go up to an organization, you say, I have a complaint and it's not heard, they can put up a .sucks site. So have you looked? Is there a mylibrarysucks.com? I mean, it'd be nice if there were. That means at least they care enough about us. But the point is that on an internet environment, if you don't enable conversation, if you don't allow conversation, conversation will move somewhere else. Conversation is what people are looking for, and it's not so they can just talk. It's so they can learn and know and shape their worlds. What they want the online environment to look like are those first examples of this plus this equals this. They want to show you and see the connections in their world. What's a blog role? A blog role is their way of saying, this is the network of which I am a part. Right? It's a way of connecting the universe that makes sense to them. Does our library allow them to come into online, in person, to connect their world and shape their world? Or does it say, here's what the world looks like. Get used to it. Right? We need to question tradition. We need to, on a regular basis, ask, should we still be doing this? I said this in San Antonio in, when was that, 2005? Who in the world dictated that virtual reference looked like a big open pane, a chat box that scrolls up on the side? The answer is Steve Kaufman forced us into it when they went with, what was it, eGain. It was eGain, and suddenly everyone copied it, and it's nuts. Why does it look the way it looks? Why do we call it Ask a Librarian? Why do we call it Adult Service? Why do we call it Reference? Why do we call it... I'm not saying you can't say, well, this is a good answer. I'm willing to go with it. I'm just asking you on a regular basis, ask why. And everyone needs to ask that question, and we need to hold visionaries account. You can't let Dave come up here and shout and be very affirmative and assume that I'm right. Where's my data? Where's my theory? Where is it? When people get up and say, Library 2.0 is the answer, say, why? And everyone needs to do it. After this, come up and yell at me. And if you didn't get a chance to yell at me, send me email and say, you idiot, this is the right answer. Because if you just sit there, and you will do it, if you just sit in the back of the room and go, I'm an idiot, I would rather them yell why. I'm tired of people sitting in the back going, well, in my library, this wouldn't work. Right? Or, oh, yeah, he's having, you know, how many years has he been a librarian? Stop it! Stop! stop it! This field needs to, on a regular basis, get together every year in an annual conference and yell, why? Right? We need to, on a regular basis, ask about what is the future of reference, because the answer is you. And what is the future of library? You. This idea that somehow God gave us a building with books and said, thou shalt have a public services department, is crap. I mean, in Arizona, they got rid of Dewey, and we thought that was somehow miraculous. It was like, what? It was burned into the books? No, they just said, screw it. We'll do this. We're allowed to do that. Who said library science is done? Who said reference is done? Who said that once you got your degree, you are done? Every day we need to ask the question, why? And an equal obligation to then try and answer it when someone else asks us that question. And I don't care if you're working at the reference desk or if you're the director, you got to do it. And I'm tired of hearing people go, I don't want to become the management position because it's them. Screw it. You have an obligation. Every one of us has an obligation. If you think that ALA Council is antiquated, run for ALA Council. If you think that your director is crazy, try and take their job. I mean, if you're pissed off at library science education, come yell at us on a regular basis, but also realize that you have to agree to teach. You have to agree to mentor. This notion that somehow we're done and that we're just waiting for the next Dave Lankus or the next Steve Kaufman or the next Stephen Abramson to stand up and say, this is the direction we shall all go, is nuts. Unless I start growing a long beard and have a staff and a couple of tablets with 10 things on them, I can make this crap up. Right? And you can too. This is what we're doing. So when you look at why social, here's my answer. Conversations, knowledge, learning. I have a theory behind it. I have data. Let's try it. Let's see if it works. And if it doesn't work, come back and say, nope, didn't work. Let's try this. You have that obligation. So with that, I will shut up and take questions.
Do I have time for questions or anything? No.
But we do have some questions because we're going to have Michelle and Caleb come up and give you all an opportunity to ask questions of all three. And if any of you panelists want to have any concluding remarks, I invite you to do that also.
Okay. So we sit. You ask.
I stay. I'll stay.
Thank you, David.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Wow. Questions or comments? Do you want me to play?
Yeah, I'll play. This is something I actually brought up with Caleb just in conversation, but it's something I've been thinking about throughout all these presentations, and so much of our kind of 2.0-ian service. I get that from Linda Asher, the lipstick librarian.
Yes.
This kind of like, you know, we've got this technology and we're using instant messaging and texting and so forth. So much of it is tied to the accelerated pace of our society, and this is something that's been going on throughout the 20th century and now the 21st, is that things keep getting faster and faster and faster, and yet if we're to facilitate knowledge, I really feel somehow or other we need to facilitate time for reflection. Because I don't think people, we can all think fast and it's great to get our brains active and moving, but there are times when we need to slow down and think and reflect and build things slowly and move a little slowly because... Well, we have a tendency to rush into things sometimes. It can be bad.
Well, it's interesting that in the public library context, I'm working with the Free Library of Philadelphia, and one of the things they're worried about is in the public sphere, there's the sense that of the library's haven that I go to escape something. And the question becomes, if you suddenly make the library a noisy, loud place of conversation, where does that happen? And the answer is that, first of all, we have to define conversation, which a conversation can happen within oneself. And, in fact, that's what you're talking about, is this ability to talk and self-reflect
and metacognition. And so what's interesting, though, is you see that in public libraries, instead of the idea of a public activities room and then a very quiet building, it becomes a public loud space and a quiet room. And I think that looking at physical layouts of facilities where Brooklyn College, they have this huge room about this big, and it's just full of carrels that are dividers with places to plug a laptop in. And I think a lot of us have seen that we go to information commons, for example, in academic settings, which is as a place for someone to come and work, and then to invite us in when they need. And so we need to be inviting and available. But I'm talking a lot. I don't know if you guys have thoughts to that.
I thought that was pretty good there.
Okay.
So you can keep that.
Okay, thanks. Is that me? Okay.
I've been thinking about, like you said, especially about the using conversations learning. And I'm not so convinced that once people reach, you know, that love learning happens, like, you know, from birth to maybe through 12th grade. I'm convinced after 12, it's just they want to get knowledge just for the sake of, they have to produce them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not for the sake of any putting any concepts together,
mm-hmm.
or looking at the big picture. Then maybe later in life, you know, they start looking at the big picture and how maybe all this prior learning has come about. So I guess my question is, in a university setting, is it the fault, not our fault, I mean, is it our place to provide? Students seem to have no time. They have no time to sit out and learn concepts of how economic theory started in 18th. They just want to know who was the first to say stop.
Let me be real clear on a couple of things. One, my definition of knowledge, and there's the same thing called Graham's taxonomy, which talks about, you've heard it, you probably haven't heard it referred to as that, but data, information, knowledge, wisdom. Right? Mike Eisenberg once took that and said, I don't like wisdom because no one knows what that means. So he said, data, information, knowledge, action. And it was the ability by which we can accomplish our goals. Right? So I have a very broad definition, and I actually like Gordon Pass' use of the word knowing as opposed to knowledge, because knowledge sounds like it's a thing. Knowing is an activity. And I will answer that question in the sense that I have new countertops and a new backsplash. And while that sounds completely unrelated, I had to take the old tile off, and I had to then like learn how to drywall to fix it, which for me was an amazing task. And I would argue that I can do that after I'm out of college, and that is, in fact, gaining knowledge, that is knowing. And so the idea that some K-12 students, I once heard a wonderful school librarian talk about, we do a really good job because students know what the difference is between searching Google and searching a reputable online thing of peer-reviewed journals. And that was a success. And I said, of course they do, because you've told them that if they go search Google and they cite that in their paper, they get an F. If they search this and they put it cited, they get an A. What have they learned? Have they learned what is cited review journalism, what it's for, or have they learned how to game the system? But that's still all knowing. That's learning. That's knowledge. But I'll shut up.
I'd have to say that I think our students are learning all the time. If you go onto people's Facebook profiles, you can see the different activities that they're doing. And they're learning. They're learning. I know what it's missing. They're learning different things, just they don't necessarily think of it as gaining knowledge. They think of it as doing an activity, which is fine. And that kind of goes back to what you were saying about the idea of it leading to action. I learned how to make dog food from scratch.
And I can build you a little wall that you can put dog food in.
Yeah, and I'm an idealist also. And I believe that people learn throughout their whole lives and that people are capable of learning. And that's why I think that librarians can change, but I no longer work in an academic library, but I did work in a few about, I'm not saying how
long. Yeah, don't do it.
Yeah, don't do
it. It's a trap.
And also that we learn different kinds of things, we learn different ways, and one of the things working with so many 5th and 6th and 7th and 8th graders on our virtual reference service is that we've developed critical thinking skills over our lifetimes that they are just starting to grasp, and reading skills that we've got all this background, just like we were talking about, that they don't have yet. And so when we send them a page that says, they want to know how many children Abraham Lincoln had, and we send them a page that's got the information, had a conversation about it, but we didn't, you know. And then they say, well, tell me the information. And then you say, it's right on the page. Something's missing, that they haven't learned how to get that out. And I talk to teachers and they say, well, yeah, they do. They know how to read a page and find out how many kids Abraham Lincoln had. But I think that we take a lot of that for granted. Politically, I'm really against vocational education in a lot of ways. I think that the skills that we need for our lives come from really abstract ideas. I'm a product of a liberal arts education. And what I found was the first 10 years after college, I knew none of that. I mean, I used none of it. But now, my critical thinking skills and my written skills are much more valuable. Now, at the same time, if you look at the National Center for Education Statistics reports on this, and they have great reports, but they're always, people who graduated in 1996 are now doing this. But, people who have degrees like I do make the least amount of money out of anybody in the world. So I think we're fighting to, I don't like to talk about fighting. I think that the ethics and the politics of libraries are very different than that what's around us. And I think it's worth doing anyway. And I know that doesn't really come close to answering. It was on my mind.
Other questions? Rennie?
I have to follow up on that question. What struck me was about, they don't have time to learn economic content. Well, they do have time, but they choose not to. They spend their time on the things that they want to know. And I'm not sure that, technology is a wonderful thing, and I'm all for it, and especially using it right. It also, in some ways, has created this disservice, because everything now has to be in quick sound bites, quick things, and not life is not life things.
I always...
We can agree to disagree.
No. It's just a matter of, I always think that the idea that somehow speed and quality are mutually exclusive things are not necessarily true.
No, I agree with that. But think about, I don't know how to find this journal article. Do it for me. But I can set up my Facebook page, which I struggle with myself, in no time flat. It's because that's what they want to do. They don't want to learn. I mean, I didn't want to learn physics. I was a music major. I didn't need to know physics, but now I wish I did. But it's where your interest lies,
right?
And how to get the spark that interest. Going along with what you were saying about not giving them the answer, but helping them to have a conversation. How to approach it in such a way that you spark their interest.
It's a good point, and what I'd like to say is conversations are two part entities. And in fact, when I talk about a lot of this, one of the normal questions I get about the notion of knowledge is created through conversation and user-oriented, it almost always devolves into which conversation should the library should be supporting. Meaning, if the kid just wants the article, should we bother answering that question? They're trying to figure out what to do on Friday night, should we answer that question? And how do we prioritize the conversations? And I say we do that every day. I mean, we do a collection development policies, things of that nature. But it's a two-way conversation. If the library holds certain values to be important, then we have an obligation as part of that conversation to explore it and broach it with the patron. So when Caleb talked about privacy, we find privacy so absolutely and tantamount important that we don't talk about it. We talk about it amongst ourselves, but we don't talk about the patrons. We did there was a discussion about teaching kids about credible information on the internet, what's good information, what's bad internet, and a bunch of authors on this topic came to the same conclusion, which is you cannot teach about credible internet information within school contexts, because we don't allow bad information into school contexts. I mean, it's like teaching a worm to have a knife fight. If you never give them the obligation to have a hand, that's a bad example. But think about it for a moment. You talked about, I heard about are a lot of priorities. What I heard about in all these questions were a lot of things that people here hold as important. Time, reflection, the idea of going beyond directed or vocational education, the notion of learning for learning's sake to a degree, the need for skills. Those are things that are part of a discourse. And so, for example, at my university, we have them on a regular basis where we say, how do we learn, how do we think? I've been in many communities that have the everyone reads the same book. That's a way of having a discourse or a dialogue with the community. You're just using a book as a way of prompting it. So in Philadelphia, it was, I forget, but it dealt with immigration. And you know, here's a great book that suddenly talked about immigration. And so where do we take that? How do we facilitate it? How many conversations, when they come to our library, do we start that we never finish up? Caleb talked about the idea of fleshing out these people from just a question. What facility do we get to continue that conversation over time? What, you know, do we let them get into their transcripts and look and add into it? Do we give them the ability to create these lists? And do we give them the ability to author our systems? What we've done is we've said we believe in all this and we're going to tell you that that's what's important. Instead of saying, well, why do you find gaming really interesting? Because it turns out there's a lot of information literacy skills that are learned in gaming. Wow, what can you teach us about that topic? And that's a conversation. I think a lot of time libraries are lecturing. And we're wondering why people aren't talking back. Well, you know, I was a kid. When my father did this, this was not a time to go, well, you know, let's talk about this.
Until you're a teenager.
No, no. Big man.
I think one thing that we kind of forget is that when you come to somebody to ask a question, when you come to the reference desk, you tend to have the feeling that you failed yourself in some way because you didn't know the answer.
That's good.
So we're already getting somebody who's vulnerable and down on themselves for not being able to do something that they think they should have been able to do. And then oftentimes we come at it at the wrong approach. And I think that we as librarians, as I watch reference transactions happening on the desk, we're failing the students because we are doing it too quickly. Or we're not listening to what their question is, but trying to quickly produce something because we think they want to be in and out as quickly as possible. And the best example that I have of this, which I just think is great, I was working with one of our UCLA football players. I was the third librarian he'd come in to see. And they know that they have the two librarians, contacts in the library. And he sits down and he goes, Michelle, I'm writing about shoes. And I said, well, what are you writing about shoes? Like, what about shoes? And he's, you know, he's trying to explain to me. And so I start to go in and I do a search, and I'm like, well, what about this article? And he goes, oh, no, I already got that one from that other librarian. That's not what I'm looking for. And so then he started to tell me where he saw his other transactions with librarians where they'd gone wrong. And I got this completely different perspective. He's like, see, she thought that I just wanted articles, and she kept giving me all this stuff, but I didn't want articles on that. I'm not interested in that part of the shoe. I'm interested in this part of the shoe. And as we kept talking, we realized he wasn't talking about shoes at all. He just wasn't sure how to articulate his point. And we have these interactions where we feel really good about how we feel having worked with a student, and we get really excited because we don't have them very often. And I think the problem is we're not necessarily spending enough time to get to have these all the time. Whenever we work with a student, we should feel this little, yay, I did good. And, you know, I find that we are doing that less and less because we think they want it fast. And we think they want just the article, and that's not always the case. So maybe we need to slow down a little bit too.
This is great. You know, it's just striking me how it would be great to look at dating advice versus reference advice and how close they might be. You're rushing it. Take it slow. Play the field a bit first.
Hey, with that, we could say that was football.
Oh, yeah, there we go. We've got analogies going everywhere.
Other questions?
I have a question about user-centered service design. I think a lot of you sort of talked about, you know, the importance of when we're thinking about reinventing reference. The point of it is for the benefit of our users, whoever they may be. And I guess I'm coming to this question from the perspective of an academic librarian. I was pretty recently an undergraduate. So for me, it's sort of fresh in my mind, like what, how undergraduates think, what types of things they're interested in, how they, you know, how they think about homework and going to class, and how they might want to use the library. But I know that as I continue on in my career, I will become I'll be getting farther and farther away from the undergraduate experience. And so as you're thinking about sort of designing services or even coming up with what services to implement or what sort of programs to use, some of you did touch on this, but what techniques do you use to sort of stay in the world of the students, or I guess the users in the case of public libraries, and make sure that you really are designing user-centered services?
I'll just start briefly. Andrew Dillon, who's the dean at the University of Texas at Austin, who showed me the Gutenberg, a fine man in a fine location, got up and said, user-centered is dead. It's a meaningless phrase. Because what happens is if you gather the right kind of user, you can get the answer you want. What we're seeing is an evolution from expert design, meaning we know what they should need, so we design a system, to user-based design, where we consult and ask the users what they want, and then go build the system, to user systems. What Facebook and MySpace and these social networking sites are, is they are brief little bits of functionality that almost completely become at the service of the user to build the world and system around them. And APIs, application programming interfaces for the techies among us, so that if we didn't build you the right one, you can build your own, which is how Google Maps. And I think what we need to stop doing is thinking about how can we design this for them, and start thinking about how can we facilitate them building a system for themselves, building around. And I know that sounds like great rhetoric, but if you look at MySpace and you look at Facebook, you look at Flickr to a great degree with the use of tagging, and you look at these are systems of texting is actually a really interesting example, because in the Philippines, texting is how people communicate because of different rates, whatever. They built the communication system based on the really simple functionality of sending a quick text. How would ask the question, how would a user design our website? Let the user design your website.
I like that. Can we just let them run around and redesign the library too?
Yeah.
No, I like that too, but I think it's kind of a cop-out in that... See, I'm having controversy.
Yeah.
In that... Very few of us are in a position to do that. That as reference librarians and as managers of reference services, we don't have the technical skills, we don't have the hardware, the server, the power to build someone an API or even to let somebody in and let them rearrange the furniture. We work towards that.
We don't have permission.
But what we can do is talk to the people that are coming in already and serve them better and work towards the kind of thing that Dave is talking about.
And there isn't just one user; there are competing users with competing interests that they have,
But just in the interest of fueling the controversy, so we can have the next ALA annual, that's the cop out. We don't have the systems, we don't have the technical knowledge, we don't have the servers. Guys, I'm sorry. You know what? We live in the Internet age, and if you want to be part of the Internet age, technical skills are required here. And I think that the cop-out of this huge body of open-source software that if you want to set up a social network site and someone says no, go to Ning.com. Click, 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 done. You want to set up a blog and they say no, go to Blogger.com. Click, 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 done. Oh, but that's going to, and if someone, have the good fight. I think oftentimes we look at this and we say that it's not our job to make this determination. If the policy's wrong, change it. If they won't change it over time, and I understand I exist in a world where I lose sometimes in these conversations, you know what? At least I put in the fight, and I'm going to try and find some other way around it. But I just can no longer accept the idea that librarianship is not defined as a technical field. If these are the people who developed MARC, and AACR2, and you want obscure, crazy technology with lots of initials on it, you guys win. You beat the IT folks on a regular basis. And so how do you learn it? Have the conversations. Have these connections. And if we're in a setting where, the state of Oregon, we have to worry about privacy and we have to worry about this. Did we ever even ask the lawyers about whether this works or not? I was talking to folks in the Department of Justice, and they're like, we can't put that information out. It's privileged. Oh, yeah? Who said? Well, we just know it's privilege. I said, if only there was a lawyer you could ask around here. Okay?
I think that I understand that there are some things that we can't do and letting the users run rampant and develop their own systems, but we have examples in things like Facebook and MySpace. And going halfway and saying things like we're going to let people tag today and think that we've accomplished something revolutionary, I'm done. I'm sorry, I hate to be cranky.
Okay, I got to cut in here because I went from an environment at UC Merced where I could do all of those things to working at an ARL library. And I think my job since September when I started at UCLA has just been to fight. And it doesn't seem like any amount of fighting I do really works, because in a lot of organizations, we have people who are in the administrative position, and I'm not saying UCLA, I'm saying in general, since it's the same podcast, that very much see the importance of the organization above the importance of the user. So if I was to go on Blogger and create a blog, which I did, I very quickly was shut down and told I had to remove it. And I was told that by everybody. Our administration, legal, LIT, the IT department, the whole entire thing. I wanted to make a flyer. I had to run that through communication. And yes, we realize that there's flaws in the way that we do things. But when I talk to my colleagues, I'm not the only one who faces these problems. So it's great to stand up there at the podium and say, go out there, make a difference, and fight these fights and fight these changes. There are some institutions where it doesn't matter how hard you fight and how much design you do and how much work you put in it and how many documents you have to support that this is the way to do it. They don't care. And they're not going to move it forward. So then you are faced with the question of, how do I do what I can do in my limited amount of space to get a new service started and to move that service forward? And that's where we have to really think outside the box even more, because we're trapped in the box and there's no doors. And so we have to figure out how can we just build a window and do those little things.
Amen. We have 5 more minutes, so we need to bring this up.
And we have a question.
You want to talk bureaucracy, it's ginormous, and I think you're absolutely right about knowing what you have control over and then trying to do something within your sphere. But at the same time, we have to start questioning, why don't we take our choice and go to the places and make really great organizations and let those other organizations figure out that they're not going to succeed without the right people or making the transition.
You work in the state of California. How many people do you talk to? You talk to 30 million people? Okay, so you go to an organization that can do this thing, and how many people are you going to be talking to? 11. You're going to be talking to 11 people, because when you get an organization that is big enough, talk to 30 million people. You have rules, you have laws, and you get sued.
I've worked at 5 libraries now. This thing's expensive. I think that the mindset is there that they do want to move forward. I mean, you know, places create the user-centered library, the emerging technologies library. You see these job postings all over. And yes, they want to do it conceptually. When that person shows up and they realize what's actually going to happen, they get very, very scared. Or maybe scared is not the right word, UCLA people who are listening. It's a fear of failure.
You know, my corollary to the why question is why not? And I'm not also going to say anything about it. And I feel like that's what, you know, is complicating. Why not?
I'm going to tell you guys all something. It's okay to fail. You actually learn more from your failures. UC Merced, I had this idea that I thought was brilliant. It totally tanked. Not only did it tank, but the completely inappropriate comments that I got from students when I let them make little video diary entries that we were going to post to the website. Frightening. You want to talk about lawsuits? That was the project. So I had to go, oops. And I let it go, and it disappeared from our website. And it's no big deal. I didn't take it personally. The institution didn't take it personally. And we have to make our institutions understand that it's okay to fail. And maybe when they see that all of the young talent that they've hired is looking for other jobs, they'll figure it out. But unfortunately, as I talk to colleagues of mine who've been doing this for a while, they say that this is what's been happening for the last 10, 15 years. 5 new people come in, 6 people leave. 6 new people come in, 10 people leave.
Then it's got to stop with us. I mean, yes, I'm a pragmatist and I'm an idealist, and I've been in a situation where people have shut me down because they made the wrong choice. But you know what? If we keep trying to fail and you keep bringing those things up, eventually you'll break through. And if you don't, go somewhere else. And the other problem that we have is that, yes, we have fear, and the fear isn't even just a failure. The fear is, will we exist next year? I can tell you many librarians who had the same question that Caleb did about, oh, libraries are going to put out of business. You find just as many people in the profession as outside asking that question. And we got to get over that. And we've got to say, wait a minute, this is the job and business that we're in. And yes, I understand that bureaucracies are there in part to support themselves. But by God, if we don't try, then we've given up. And I don't want to ever live in a world we've given up. And I'm tired of hearing someone else always say someone else is the one who won't change. Fine. Do you have people under you?
Me?
Yeah.
I think they're afraid to let people work for me.
I can't tell you the number of people like you that they said, oh, I turned down that management position because then I won't be able to do all this cool stuff. So we need to get you people to work under you so that you can be the first link in that chain. I hear you. We will lose, we will fight, but if we stop fighting, we will fail. And that scares the hell out of me.